The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burn Rate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister.
Hello and welcome to Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. I'm here with Guy Jafredi to talk about the startup scene with a focus on venture capital. This is episode 64, recorded on Thursday, September 25th at 9 p.m. This podcast is brought to you by our partners Upscaler.ch and Omnium. Guy, what's on the agenda today?
In the news, we'll look at Taylor's latest acquisition, the launch of the new HSG Accelerator, and NVIDIA's $100 billion investment into OpenAI. For our deep dive, we'll talk about a topic relevant to every startup, product market fit. We've invited Michael Sauter to join us for that conversation. And before we cover this week's transactions, we'll take a listener question from Lucas. What actually makes a startup a VC case? But first, some late-breaking news came in after our editorial deadline. You know more about it than anyone. Move Again has acquired Moovu. And since you're on the board there, how did you actually get involved with Move Again?
We didn't prepare for this, but I had a feeling you'd bring it up. Move Again really is a bit of an evergreen. Yes, I'm on the board there, but I also co-founded the company quite a few years back. I'd have to check how long ago exactly. I remember it clearly, though. Back then, I was at Swiss Startup Factory. I was always the first in the office in the morning, fit enough back then. One morning after vacation, I showed up around 5 a.m. because I had to finish something urgent, and there was actually someone else already there. That annoyed me because mornings were my quiet time, no one to disturb me. Turned out it was Mladjan, the founder of Move Again. We started talking, and he explained what he was building. I knew Moovu existed at the time, their competitor, and Balois had just come on board as an investor there. That made the whole setup really interesting. I later visited Mladjan in his office, which was way out in Altstetten. When I walked in, I saw about 5,000 moving boxes piled up. He popped his head out from behind one of them. That's how the conversation started, and I thought the case was promising. We went over the unit economics together and decided to launch the company jointly. We brought in our first CEO, and with him, we scaled incredibly fast. After a few years, we had to pivot. Performance marketing costs had shot up so fast that even though we had product market fit, suddenly the case wasn't profitable anymore. That was a big learning moment for me, how quickly things can change. We brought in Dominik Schütz as CEO, and he reshaped the business model. Then we had the chance to acquire Movinga, the German market leader with subsidiaries across Europe. Movinga once hit 50 million euros in revenue, but with 50 million euros in losses. Crazy, right? Their model simply didn't work. Still, we analyzed it and saw a way to make it work. Maybe not the typical full-throttle VC case, but in a more disciplined way. That turned out well. At the same time, I stayed in touch with Moovu's leadership, especially the chairman, who was also with Balois. We realized that in Switzerland, two competing players would just hurt each other in a market that's too small for both. That's when negotiations began. After several intense months, we were finally able to announce today that Move Again has acquired Moovu. So yes, that's the big news.
And Moovu, of course, was a big exit back in 2021 when Balois acquired the company. Many of the founders and team members from Moovu are now active investors themselves. That means the exit must have gone quite well for them. Can you share what you actually paid for this new transaction?
Nice try. You caught me. I always push other founders to be transparent about their deals. But now that it's my turn, I'll have to stay quiet. Of course, I can't disclose details. What I can say is that we worked out a fair deal for everyone involved. Move Again is still very much a startup, especially after our pivot, so we had to restructure and find our footing again. But we have fantastic investors backing us, and new ones also joined to make this deal possible. So yes, I'd say the outcome was fair for all parties.
All right, fair enough. So what's next for Move Again? How will the integration work?
That's the big focus now. Closing is on Tuesday, and right after that, we'll move straight into integration. There are still a number of open questions we didn't have time to fully address yet, and now we need to work through all of them so the combined business runs smoothly. I'm really looking forward to the coming months.
Great news for the Swiss startup ecosystem. Congrats to Mladjan, Dominik, Max, and of course to you and the whole team that made this happen. After Movinga in Germany, now the Swiss champion is taking shape with Move Again. Exciting to see where it goes from here.
Thank you. Now let's get into this week's news. We've got a big update from the Swiss fintech ecosystem. Zurich-based Taylor has acquired Dusseldorf's CapeTech GmbH. Together with Credit Shelf, which they'd already integrated, and their SaaS arm Taylor Technologies, Taylor is building one of Europe's leading SME financing platforms. Their focus is a white-label SaaS solution for banks and partners. In other words, a platform strategy that's both organic and driven by acquisitions. It's a very aggressive M&A play. Guy, what's your take? Is it smart for a fintech startup to lean so heavily into acquisitions this early, or is that a risk of spreading themselves too thin?
There's always that risk, of course, but this isn't Taylor's first acquisition. We've covered others here on Burn Rate. So far, their integrations seem to have gone well, which is usually the toughest part. It's still a bold move, but I get it. In fintech, speed is everything. If you can accelerate by acquiring technology, talent, or customers, that can create an edge, or at least help you catch up quickly. The danger, as I said, is in the integration. Many startups stumble after the initial hype of an acquisition, when the hard work of merging teams and systems begins. That's a real stress test for any young company.
Right, and taking a step back, Taylor is building a platform ecosystem through these deals. Do you think that's a model we'll see more often in European fintech, startups growing through consolidation?
Absolutely. In fragmented markets like fintech, consolidation is the logical move. Smaller players grow into bigger ones, and big incumbents pick up strategic startups for new tech or capabilities. The real question is whether someone like Taylor can truly become a leading pan-European platform, or if nimble national specialists will still manage to outpace them.
Good point. Moving on, another piece of news from the Swiss startup scene. The very first cohort of the HSG Start Accelerator has kicked off. The University of St. Gallen wants to use this program to support young founders with coaching, access to networks, and help with initial funding. As investors, we find these programs valuable because they act as a kind of pre-selection filter, and I believe you had the chance to meet some of the startups at their virtual open office on Thursday, right?
Yes, exactly. This morning I joined one of the sessions, and I've actually been in touch with the accelerator team for quite a while. I know Tim Mosser from the time he worked for Microsoft for startups. So I've been happy to support the HSG Start Accelerator whenever I can. Our ecosystem needs this kind of push, and we need more initiatives like it to raise the overall quality of our startups. This morning, four startups pitched. I spent about half an hour with each, challenging their presentations. There were some interesting companies, not just the typical polished business plans you'd expect from HSG. Some actually had real technological depth behind them.
And accelerators are almost standard now in the startup ecosystem. How important do you think these programs are, now, especially in a market where there's more and more competition and so many different offerings?
I still think they're extremely important. Accelerators give founders a protected space to test their models. They get feedback, they can spot mistakes early, and they can fix them in a supportive environment. And we shouldn't forget, for many founders, this is their very first time building a company or being in the role of CEO. For them, access to mentors, sparring partners, and a network of entrepreneurs is invaluable. Sure, there are lots of programs out there and quality varies widely. Founders need to ask themselves before committing their time, what exactly will this program do for us? Do they have the right mentors, the right network, the right expertise for our case? With the HSG Start Accelerator, what stood out to me was the professionalism and seriousness with which they work with startups. And of course, having the HSG brand behind them gives them real weight in the Swiss ecosystem.
Let's get into the details a bit. What are the first signals you look for in a startup coming out of an accelerator batch that might make it interesting for us as investors?
At this early stage, it's really about the founders themselves, their clarity of vision, but also their honesty in how they answer questions. You get a first impression quickly, but you need multiple interactions to really validate it. And you can't just talk to one founder. You need to know if the whole team is aligned and capable of pushing through the ups and downs together. Second, I look at the market pain. Is it more than just a nice idea? Is their solution 10 times better than what exists today? That's what we'll also dive into with Michael later when we discuss product market fit. And third, I look at traction. Are there any indicators of where the startup stands? LOIS, pilot customers, early revenues? And can the team convincingly show that their case has real substance? You can usually spot that fairly quickly in accelerators. And I have to say, the startups I saw today were strong. One caveat, though, when you hear a startup boasting about lots of LOIS, dig into them. Sometimes an LOI is really just a nice endorsement letter with a fancy title.
All right, let's move to what might be the biggest headline this week in tech. NVIDIA plans to invest up to $100 billion into OpenAI in exchange for a significant equity stake in the ChatGPT maker. Together, they aim to build up to 10 gigawatts of computing capacity. OpenAI will commit to buying millions of NVIDIA chips, while NVIDIA gradually takes ownership in OpenAI. If executed fully, this would be the largest private investment deal of all time. It's a mega deal that ties OpenAI even more closely to NVIDIA and secures NVIDIA's central role in the AI industry for years to come. Guy, how do you see this move? What does it mean for NVIDIA, for OpenAI, and for the entire industry?
NVIDIA has to put its massive positive cash flow to work somehow, and this agreement is a game changer for them. It cements their role as the essential enabler of the AI ecosystem. For OpenAI, it guarantees long-term access to huge amounts of compute power, likely on favorable terms, since NVIDIA is now also an investor. For the industry, it means dependency on NVIDIA grows even further. Their moat just got much deeper, making it even harder to displace them from the throne. As a result, startups and big corporations alike will find it nearly impossible to avoid their tech stack. For NVIDIA, it's practically a win-win. Today, their revenue multiple is about 25. I checked just before this recording. That means every $1 of revenue adds about $25 in market value. If roughly half of that $100 billion goes into NVIDIA chips for these data centers, say $50 billion, then NVIDIA could create about $1.25 trillion in additional market cap. It's an enormously positive deal for them.
Right. Those numbers are staggering. $100 billion exceeds even the largest deals in tech history. At the same time, NVIDIA and OpenAI are essentially investing in each other. NVIDIA puts money into OpenAI and OpenAI spends it back on NVIDIA chips. Do you see this more as a smart strategic alliance for NVIDIA or as a risky dependency for OpenAI?
It depends on your perspective. For OpenAI, I see it as much riskier. They need deals like this to achieve their extremely ambitious goals, but it locks them into a strong dependency on NVIDIA. If NVIDIA ever faced issues, or if there were a genuine technological shift, OpenAI could suddenly be very vulnerable, especially if the deal includes exclusivity clauses that force them to buy only NVIDIA chips. For NVIDIA, it's more like a masterstroke. I doubt they agreed to exclusivity on their side. They'll still be free to supply Anthropic, xAI, and others. So with just part of their cash, they've secured massive future revenue streams and bought influence in one of the sector's most valuable players. Without limiting themselves, they get both cash flows and strategic positioning. No wonder they're now the world's most valuable company.
With Omnium, you can close your financing round faster and more successfully. Our partner Omnium is an innovative growth financing platform. They offer a fully digital, streamlined, and cost-efficient process, including the legal framework, investor KYC, and payment handling. If you're raising with Omnium, you can choose a private round, using just the platform for your investment opportunity. Or you can choose Private Round Plus, which adds access to 10,000 registered investors. If you want maximum visibility and reach, go for the public round, which makes your raise accessible to all investors. With Omnium, you'll close your financing round faster and more successfully. And if your goal is to scale quickly and sustainably, not just grow, then the Upscaler program is perfect for you. It connects you with a broad pool of founders, entrepreneurs, and the right investors. More than 50 startups have already benefited from over 500 workshops, scaling their businesses nationally and internationally. Want to join? Find all the info at www.upscaler.ch.
Let's turn to today's deep dive topic, product market fit. Few concepts determine success or failure as clearly as this one. Get it right, and you lay the foundation for growth, follow-on funding, and lasting customer retention. Miss it, or declare it too early, and you risk burning capital and exhausting your team. That's what's often called premature scaling. Product market fit doesn't just mean landing your first customers. It's about solving a real market problem so well that demand almost generates itself. That's what we're talking about today with Michael Sauter, one of the leading experts on the topic. Michael not only wrote the book Product Market Fit, How to Build a Business That Scales, which you can actually download for free online, but he also founded PMF Factory, a program that systematically helps founders on their journey to achieving fit. And he knows the founder's perspective firsthand. As co-founder of an ETH spin-off, he experienced how difficult, but also how decisive, this milestone can be in practice. Today, we want to clarify with Michael, how do you actually recognize product market fit? Which methods really help? Which mistakes do founders keep making? And above all, how can investors and founders approach the topic together to avoid scaling too early or too late? Michael, welcome.
Thanks a lot for having me. I'm excited for the conversation.
Let's get straight to the central question. What does product market fit mean to you personally? And why is it so critical for founders?
For me, product market fit is when a product solves a problem or addresses a need so effectively that the market starts pulling it. At the end of the day, we want demand to grow so the company can scale efficiently. But at the same time, customer acquisition costs must come down. Growth has to get easier, not harder. That efficiency is what makes PMF such a central element of sustainable scaling.
Many founders think they've already achieved PMF once they've got a few customers or some early revenue. What are the clear signals for you that PMF is really there and not just luck, a pilot project, or a handful of early adopters?
I can say from experience, I once thought I had PMF in my own startup. In the first year, we won the biggest nursing home group in Switzerland as a client. But the question was, are they early adopters and why did they buy? For me, a central element is that you can repeatedly create happy customers, not just one, but many. That means you found the key to making customers successful. Second, as we mentioned, customer acquisition costs have to go down. It should get easier to win customers, not harder. And third, I want to see demand pull. Spontaneous inbound calls like, hey, I heard you're using this product, we want it too. Or customers actively recommending you. Sometimes it's easier to define the opposite. You definitely don't have PMF if customers can live without your solution. If they say, we can just do it like before. If there's no organic growth, if every customer requires a hard push, then PMF isn't there yet.
Do sales cycles also shorten once you hit product market fit, or is that unrelated?
Absolutely. PMF means you have something the customer must have. You're hitting a nerve by solving a relevant problem. And not only do they want it, they actually experience that it solves the problem.
If we zoom out to the US, Mark Andreessen from a 16Z once said, PMF is when customers are ripping the product out of your hands. Think of iPhone launch lines. In your experience, is that realistic? So more of a Silicon Valley myth?
That's the dream, of course. Building such a cool product that everyone has to have it and you can't keep up with demand. Maybe it's best seen as an ideal state. We usually talk about four levels of PMF. Level one, you found customers who buy and are happy with the product. Level two, you can do this repeatedly. You've figured out the formula and you start to see some organic effects, but growth is still fairly linear. Level three, things accelerate, you feel the pull, organic demand kicks in and scaling becomes much faster. Level four, that's the extreme case. People literally rip the product out of your hands. Level four is rare. Honestly, most startups never get beyond level two.
And what quantitative metrics do you use to measure PMF?
We always recommend measuring across four dimensions, a customer success, track NPS, usage data, or a customer success score. It's not just about customers saying they're happy. You also want to see them using the product more and more. Repeatability. Can you replicate sales success consistently, regardless of the channel, salesperson, or situation? Profitability per customer. For example, is the payback period getting shorter? Are CACs going down? Demand signals. Are you getting more inbound? Is your referral rate increasing? Do you see signs of virality? Each startup needs its own tailored metric set, but those are the four pillars we work with.
In Europe, founders often have less capital than in the US. How can they test efficiently for PMF with limited resources?
Interestingly, bigger teams aren't always more efficient in the search for PMF. Large teams can actually be slower, especially if you still need to pivot or adapt frequently. Sometimes small teams of four or so can test faster. The challenge is you never know exactly when PMF will happen. It could take months or years. You just keep testing until the signals show up. For example, some companies needed 4 years to really hit it, and that's why runway is critical. The more time you have, the higher your chances of finding PMF and scaling efficiently once you do.
It can be a long road to PMF. What are the biggest mistakes founders make along the way? And how much do ego or denial play into it?
First, underestimating how much time it really takes. Many founders think it'll happen faster than it does. Second, assuming you know what the market needs. You should never say that. You have to stay close to the market. Keep investing in understanding customer problems. Often we see startups tackling issues that are technically real, but not actually top of mind for customers. And third, the most dangerous is premature scaling, scaling something that isn't yet scalable. I've lived this myself. You end up scaling not only your costs, but also your problems. Suddenly you're firefighting instead of refining your product market fit.
For us as investors, this is hugely relevant. We often invest right before product market fit is fully obvious, ideally before other investors notice it. How can we actually tell as VCs or even as board members whether a startup has really reached PMF or if they're just having a good run of sales?
That's a great and very tough question. It requires a lot of insight. I'd look at two or three layers. First, what I call team market fit. How deeply does the team really understand the market? Do they just talk about it or have they lived it? That level of embedded understanding makes a huge difference. Second, I'd go straight to customers. Call them up. Why did you buy this product? Was it because you're friends with the founder or because it truly solves a painful problem? Is the problem scalable, one that many others share? And third, we use what's sometimes called the John Ellis test. Ask the customer, if this product disappeared tomorrow, what would happen to you? If the answer is, I'll just go back to Excel, then the product isn't mission critical. If instead they say, oh no, that would be a huge problem, I'd lose money immediately, then you know you're onto something with serious potential.
Can a company also lose product market fit? Say if the market or technology changes? And how should founders respond?
Yes, absolutely. And it can happen very fast. We saw this during COVID. Some things were suddenly irrelevant while new needs emerged overnight. Today, with the speed of technological change, founders need to be even more alert to market signals. My advice, focus on a niche you deeply understand and that competitors can't easily enter. Stay incredibly close to customers and build strong advisory boards that help you detect signals early. What's shifting? What trends could you ride? What threats might blindside you? PMF isn't static anymore.
As a final question, what are your main takeaways from running the PMF factory? What would you recommend to every founder?
At its core, product market fit is a mindset. It's not, I build a product and then try to sell it with marketing and sales. It's a constant search for pull, for solving something so well that customers almost pull the product from you. That means iterating quickly, pivoting when needed, and being willing to learn fast. It also means combining data with intuition. Track KPIs like customer success metrics, profitability, usage, NPS, but also stay close enough to customers to feel what's really happening and always make progress measurable. If you're working on customer success, show the improvement. If you're optimizing profitability, show the numbers. Fast learning, measurable iteration, and a relentless focus on the pull effect. That's what founders should internalize.
Michael, thanks so much for joining us on Burn Rate and sharing these valuable insights.
Thank you very much.
Let's move on to today's listener question. Lucas from Burn writes, "Hi everyone, I'd like to know which KPIs do you actually look at to decide whether a startup is a true VC case or not?" Thanks, Lucas. That's a great and very timely question. We hear founders say all the time, we're a typical VC case, Pokikon. But what does that really mean? For us as investors, it's always a combination of scalability, growth, and efficiency. We want companies where additional capital translates into exponential growth and where there's a realistic path to a large exit or IPO. Let's walk through the key KPIs step by step. First, market size. This is the foundation. If a startup is active only in a tiny niche, it may be a great business, but rarely a VC case. Guy, what benchmarks do you look for?
TAM, total addressable market, needs to be at least a billion, ideally multiple billions, $10 billion or more. That's non-negotiable. And here's why. Venture capital only works if we have home run scenarios. At the early stage, we need companies that can return 100 times on a single investment. Remember, our LPs expect the fund overall to deliver a 3 to 4 times return over 10 years. That means in a portfolio of, say, 30 companies, each investment has to carry the potential to return the entire fund. So yes, TAM has to be big enough that even with just 5% market share, the company could reach hundreds of millions in revenue, the kind of numbers needed for a big exit. Tech also has to be internationally scalable. Niche markets aren't always a deal breaker, but then there must be a clear strategy to expand into bigger adjacent markets over time.
Okay, let's move to growth. In early stages, expectations here are brutally high. A Series A startup that isn't growing at least 100% annually is tough to sell as a VC case.
Exactly. At the beginning, the mantra is the first million, then triple it, then triple again. You want 2 to 3 times growth year over year, ideally for a few years. That requires real PMF. Later on, at Series B and C, growth of 40 to 60% annually can still be acceptable, but only if efficiency metrics are solid. VCs are still dreaming of hockey stick curves, not flat lines, and by Series B or C, profitability starts to matter. That's where the Rule of 40 comes in. Growth rate plus EBITDA margin should equal at least 40%. A startup can either grow fast and burn money, or grow moderately and be profitable. As long as it hits that combined 40%, it's still attractive.
Good point. But growth alone isn't enough. I also look very closely at unit economics, like the LTV/CAC ratio. A customer should generate at least 3 times the acquisition cost.
Yes, and don't forget the payback period. If it takes more than 12 to 18 months to recoup CAC, that's a red flag. It means the model is very capital intensive. Margins are equally critical, especially in SaaS. VCs typically expect 70 to 80% gross margins. Anything less suggests the business isn't really scalable and requires too much effort to sell. That said, in AI startups today, inference costs sometimes make it tough to reach those 70 to 80% margins. Expectations are shifting slightly, but the principle remains. Strong unit economics are essential.
For me, retention is almost more important than acquisition. Low churn and high net revenue retention, NRR, show whether a product is delivering real, lasting value.
Exactly. An NRR above 120% means existing customers generate more revenue each year through upselling, expansions, or simply increased usage. That's the investor's dream because it shows growth doesn't just come from expensive new customer acquisition, but from the existing base. We actually discussed this KPI in detail a couple of weeks ago.
And then there's efficiency. One interesting KPI, especially in SaaS, is the magic number. It measures how much new revenue is generated by the previous quarter's sales and marketing spend.
Right. And magic is always a nice word. You calculate the magic number by annualizing net new ARR from a quarter, then dividing it by sales and marketing spend from the prior quarter. If the ratio is above 0.75, that's okay. Above 1.0 means every dollar invested in sales and marketing generates at least $1 of new ARR in the same year. That's very efficient growth.
Mm-hmm. And finally, let's look at capital efficiency. The burn multiple. How many dollars does a startup have to burn to generate $1 of net new revenue? A burn multiple below 1.5 is good. Below 1.0 is excellent.
Exactly. Especially now when capital isn't limitless and growth at any cost is no longer the mantra, investors focus heavily on this metric. Whoever can convert capital into growth efficiently has a real advantage. A related point, how much total capital does the startup actually need to reach an exit? Is it 20 million, 200 million, or 2 billion? As an investor, you need to know that in order to model dilution across future rounds. Sometimes you can even leverage non-dilutive funding, but understanding that capital path is critical.
So to summarize for you, Lucas, a true VC case requires a huge market, very fast growth, healthy unit economics, strong retention, and capital efficiency. Tools like the Rule of 40 or the magic number help make these dimensions measurable. And it's never about a single metric in isolation, but the overall picture. In the very early stage, pre-seed or seed, the focus is on team, TAM, early traction, or proxies for product market fit, like we heard earlier from Michael. In the growth stage, it's about unit economics like CAC/LTV, NRR, gross margin, or burn multiple. And in later stages, Series C, D, and beyond, profitability, Rule of 40, exit multiples, and international scalability take center stage. Let's move on to the deals of the week.
Yes. Last week, about 165 million Swiss francs were invested across 10 funding rounds. We saw two exits announced, and two startups also secured Venture Kick Stage 3 grants.
Let's start with the mega round. ETH spin-off Auterion closed a $130 million Series B. The round was led by Bessemer Venture Partners, with participation from Lakestar, Mosaic Ventures, and Costanoa Ventures. Notably, around $25 million came as non-dilutive capital via the U.S. Department of Defense's Office of Strategic Capital.
Auterion has evolved from its roots as an open-source autopilot into a leading provider of AI-native defense software. With Auterion OS and the Nomics defense system, drones and unmanned systems can be integrated into coordinated fleets operating simultaneously across air, land, and sea. It's a paradigm shift. Not single expensive platforms, but autonomous swarms acting in real time.
And this isn't just theory. The tech is already being used in the Ukraine war, where Auterion is supplying tens of thousands of AI-based strike kits. It's the largest deployment of autonomous tech in the West to date. These frontline learnings flow directly into product development, showing the power of scalable, swarm-based systems.
Exactly. And alongside battlefield deployment, Auterion benefits from its open architecture, which allows interoperability across manufacturers. That clearly differentiates it from proprietary defense systems and has made Auterion a sought-after partner for major industry players like Rheinmetall and Lockheed Martin.
With headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, and engineering hubs in Zurich and Munich, Auterion is already positioned globally.
The new capital will go towards scaling the platform internationally and cementing its position as the leading software provider for autonomous defense systems, potentially becoming the operating system of modern warfare.
Another standout deal from Zurich is making waves across Europe. Anbound Potential raised 14.4 million euros in pre-seed funding, one of the largest pre-seed rounds in Europe this year. For such an early-stage tech startup, that's extraordinary. And it underscores how strategically relevant their solution for the future of energy storage is.
Their focus is membrane-free redox flow batteries, which promise to be simpler, faster, and far cheaper to produce than conventional models. The aim is to enable reliable renewable energy storage at scales suitable for data centers, EV fleets, or even entire power grids.
The round was led by Founderful with Quantit as co-lead. Also participating were ZKB, public funds like Spring D, InnoSuisse, the Migros Pioneer Fund, and even the City of Zurich's climate program. It's a strong example of combining venture capital with public funding, a model we're seeing more often in Europe for strategic technologies.
The capital will fund technology development, pilot projects, and industrial scale demonstrations. Early collaborations are reportedly already underway, including with Amazon and FlexSpace, which is building Europe's largest redox flow storage project at Laufenburg.
From Schwyz, SaaS startup Deskbird announced a $23 million Series B to expand its AI-powered workplace intelligence platform globally.
Founded in 2020, Deskbird helps companies manage workplaces. Employees can book desks, meeting rooms, or parking spaces, while employers get real-time analytics on space utilization and efficiency.
The round was led by London-based Octopus Ventures, with co-investments from Neva, AVP, 10X, German fund Alsten Capital, Carsten Maschmeyer, Session, and Portfolion.
Today, Deskbird already manages more than 10,000 offices across Europe, an impressive figure in just a few years. Customers include Samsung, Deloitte, and Airbus. With fresh capital, the team plans to enter the UK and target new sectors.
And a quick look at Western Switzerland. Adaptive Bio has officially exited beta after its $8 million seed round and opened its platform to the broader research community.
The startup runs an automated wet lab for rapid and cost-effective protein testing. Their goal? Accelerate protein engineering, which is typically slow and expensive. This could transform areas like antibodies, enzymes, or even new materials.
The round was led by Ace Ventures, with participation from Bay founders, Fundiful, Long Game, and several angels.
Adaptive Bio is already gaining traction with pharma companies and AI research labs. The team has doubled headcount and is expanding into a new lab in Lausanne.
And that wraps up this episode of Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. If you'd like to support us, subscribe to our newsletter and share it within your network. Thanks for tuning in. We wish you a great weekend. Take care and bye for now.